The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
How you doing?
Doing good.
Fantastic. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Let's get into it. For people who don't know, what is this book about?
Yeah, I mean, on a general level, I think it's about how ideas of vengeance are embedded within our criminal justice system and how that impacts families and communities, and how it has negative consequences just for the way that we think about the rule of law. In particular, it is about a young man who was wrongfully accused of murder at the age of 14. He was incarcerated for that for a time being, and that incarceration changed the trajectory of his life. And so it's about how our need to punish really impacts people and haunts them.
But it's also about you.
It is also about me, and it's also about my family,
right?
and the way that we try to cope with this tragedy.
So who is Sito?
Sito is my stepson's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's a young man that I met him once. I didn't know him well, but his life and death really had a big impact mm-hmm. on my family and a big impact on me. Firstly, because, you know, Sito's life was extraordinary in many ways, but it was also very familiar to me mm-hmm. in many ways as somebody who has spent his career as an academic studying gang violence
mm-hmm.
and police violence. I saw Sito's story and many of the young people that I've come to know and come to do research among. He shared a lot of the struggles of young people growing up
mm-hmm.
in marginalized urban communities and trying to grapple with themselves and trying to kind of figure out their path forward. But it was extraordinary. His life was extraordinary in the sense that, again, at the age of 14, he's accused of this murder. He's incarcerated. Miraculously, the public defenders on his case find evidence that he did not commit the crime. He's released. But then 5 years later, he himself gets murdered.
Mm.
By the little brother of the person he was accused of killing.
Mm-hmm.
And so those events, both his false incarceration or his wrongful conviction or his wrongful imprisonment, I should say, and his murder seem spectacular, and they're the kind of things that kind of populate our headlines when we read the news. But I really wanted to tell the story behind the story, I don't think we do that often enough. Mm.
This is all fairly recent. He was killed in 2019?
Yeah, 2019.
And the trial of the young man who shot him was in 2021?
Yeah.
Okay. So when did you decide to write about this?
Well, there's a moment that looking back on it now that I feel like I decided to write on it, and then there's a moment when I actually decided to write on it. And I think looking back, the moment that I started to write it in my mind was at his funeral, and I was there. And it was a really amazing funeral in mm-hmm. the sense that it was packed
mm-hmm.
In this really ornate cathedral. There were people pouring outside of the door. Hundreds of people were there. And his father was speaking at the podium, Sito's father.
Rene.
And he was making a plea to the young people in mm-hmm. the crowd, particularly the young men. Mm-hmm. And he was saying that we don't want you to retaliate.
Right.
We don't want you to get yourself in a position where you can get arrested, incarcerated, or killed. That's not what we want. That's not what Sito would have wanted. And he asked the young people in the crowd to turn around, to acknowledge each other, to see each other, mm-hmm. to embrace each other. And in that moment, that was a moment where I thought that the message of that moment needed to last beyond this particular service mm-hmm. and this particular funeral. And it was, I think, in that moment that I thought, something, this story needs to be told. And, you know, I don't know if it came as a conscious thought, but there was something that stayed with me. And then later I had really intense conversations with Renee, and as well as my stepson, Neto, about Sito's story. And every time we talked about it, there were additional layers that were unpacked in different ways where I thought, wow, this is just extraordinary. And it was surprising in the way that things unfolded. And that's later when I had the conscious decision that, yeah, I should write about this. But not only that, that my experience in writing my other books had somehow prepared me to write this book and had prepared me for this moment.
So was this... It's one thing for you to have that idea and revelation. It must have been another thing then to have to approach his mother and father and family members and say, I want to write a book about Sito. So what was that process like?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I feel like I'm still in the process, right? Because, yeah, there's still talks about what everything means. Like, what mm-hmm. does it mean that I'm talking about it? His life now? And what does it mean that there's this book in the world now? Mm-hmm. But I think initially, the impetus from a lot of his family members was to try to correct the narrative. And the narrative that they were referring to was the narrative that happened when he was arrested as a 14-year-old. Mm-hmm. And the narrative was that he was just a youth murderer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, his name was all over the... Well, his name wasn't in the news. There was descriptions of a youth murderer in right. the news. But of course, everyone in the community, everyone in his school, everyone he cared about knew that it was him,
right?
He was arrested inside his school. Mm-hmm. There was an online petition that circulated around and demanded that he get tried as an adult. There was a lot of pressure for the DA to try him as an adult, as a 14-year-old. And so that vilification really stayed with Sito. And mm-hmm. even after he was released and even after the video evidence was revealed that he didn't do the crime, he was still associated with mm-hmm. it. The DA explicitly said, or the DA's office explicitly said, that we're still not convinced that he's not connected in some way, and we're still investigating it. And so there was a way in which he was still connected. And so the impetus for the family was to kind of correct the narrative and really say who he was as a person, what he was trying to do, who he was trying to become, and how that vilification really impacted him.
Mm-hmm.
So the initial conversations were around that.
And how does that, the desires of the family to kind of clear the record, and because this, it's not just when he's 14 and falsely accused, arrested, and incarcerated for a murder he doesn't commit, but this comes up again in the trial of the 17-year-old who kills him. At the end of the trial, when it's time to for sentencing, and family members can give impact statements, and then, you know, the defendant gets to call character witnesses, he's called a murderer again, right?
Right, right.
So this is a kind of cloud that hangs over his story. And in some ways, it seems as if even between 14 and his murder, that this is still a cloud he's trying to get from up under, right? To get away from this characterization, either as a murderer or just the way that young black or brown men, boys in the city are characterized, that seems to have become the kind of ambition of his life, was to be seen differently. Does that?
Yeah, I think that's true in many ways. And I think on the one hand, what motivated him towards the end of his life was to really draw on what he had been through and draw on his experiences as a resource to develop himself. And he found a lot of solace in activism, mm-hmm. particularly around police and prison abolition. Mm-hmm. He was advocating for the closure of the juvenile hall that incarcerated him. And he was building an identity as someone mm-hmm. who could speak on those issues and speak powerfully on those issues. He was becoming known as someone who could speak powerfully on those issues. So that was his ambition. But at the same time, he had setbacks and struggles. Mm-hmm. And so part of what I am trying to show is that this dichotomy between the victim and the perpetrator is part of the issue, right? And our need to have this stark difference. And I'm trying to show that there is no perfect victim, right? Mm-hmm. And there is no absolutely evil perpetrator as well. And we do a disservice to our communities of color when we think in that way, because victims and perpetrators are impacted by the same issues.
Right.
And their families are impacted by the same issues, and the communities are impacted by the same issues. And so
how does that resonate with the family who feel, you know, to feel victimized twice, both
yeah.
through the murder of Sito, but also the relatively light sentence of his murderer, which you rightly point to at the end, ironically, is in part a result of the activism of Sito, who one of the things that he wanted to take up was the harsh sentencing of young people. And so what does the family think about this objective that you're pointing to, that you're trying to point out in this book?
Well, I mean, I think there is no one opinion in terms of the family, right? I think there's a spectrum of opinions. And I think some people agree with Sito and say that it actually doesn't matter if the person gets 5 years or 55 years. It's not going to bring Sito back, and it's not going to solve any issues, right? Where some people say Sito was going to be tried as an adult. And so it's unfair that his perpetrator, that's not even a consideration, mm-hmm. right? And so what I try to do is to give voice to those perspectives, the range of those perspectives, but to say what is really at issue. So I think part of the issue is not simply that some members of Sito's family want his murderer to be punished and, mm-hmm. you know, put under the jail. It's that they feel that because that's what was going to happen to Sito, they feel like it's unjust for his perpetrator to get off with a light sentence. And so, mm-hmm. and also because of what Sito went through, it makes the law seem arbitrary to them. Like in the span of 5 years, and just because there's a different election cycle, you know, mm-hmm. one's experience can be radically different with the law. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this is unique to Sito. I mean, it's kind of a facet of American politics mm-hmm. now, that the pendulum between progressive and conservative can swing back and forth so quickly.
Right.
And when I think we make a mistake, and here the we I'm talking about is progressives, I think we make a mistake when we kind of strategically say, okay, we just need to get our person in there. And mm-hmm. then it'll be our person making the decision.
Right.
Because when we do that, oftentimes we're not grappling with the fundamental issue. Right. We're not demanding that we take a national stance on this. We're not demanding that it gets decided.
Right.
Like, how do we really feel as a country about juvenile incarceration? Mm-hmm. We're not making that demand. We're just saying, okay, like, we'll just get enough votes to get our guy in
right.
there. And so I think part of the debate about how the family feels and why they feel that way has to do with the state of our politics and mm-hmm. the state of how we think about criminal justice.
So you're a social scientist, right? Anthropologist. And this book is written very different than social science or even anthropology. There are many, you know, there are obvious differences because it in some ways is personal. It involves your relationships with a range of people that are not just people you're observing, but people that you have intimate relationships with. But also, there is a lot of references to Santeria, to Orishas. And I'm wondering if you could talk some about that and your decision to include that throughout the book. It's a kind of thread that runs throughout the book. And it certainly is very different in that sense from the kind of empirical bedrock that social science is like synonymous with. So talk some about that process and decision making.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a like an academic disciplinary point of view, one of the major differences has to do with the question of objectivity and how we mm-hmm. think about objectivity, how we're trained to think about objectivity as social scientists. And just on a basic level, we're trained to think of it in a way that we're distant mm-hmm. and that anybody could kind of replicate what we are doing if we employ a particular method of doing it. And I'm not trying to do right. that in that sense. It is a subjective account. It's about the worldview of first Sito, but also a family that's grieving mm-hmm. and also myself as mm-hmm. I'm trying to navigate this. So it's intimate in that sense. And so in a way, I feel that the one of the issues with objectivity and the standard sense of it is that it doesn't allow the researcher or the writer to be vulnerable. Mm. And it presents the world that's written about as if the social scientists already knew everything before they mm-hmm. showed up, right? So there's no process of discovery. There's no uncovering. Mm. There's just, mm-hmm. let me show you what I know. Mm-hmm. And of course I know it because I'm a social scientist. Right. I'm an anthropologist. I'm a sociologist. So of course I know this, right? And that wasn't my experience. It, you know, the things that I thought I knew and that I thought I believed, I was surprised by the way I was being challenged with those thoughts, right? And so I wanted to be true to that. And I also wanted to be true to the fact that part of what makes up people's reality is not what we can see and what we can touch and what we can count, right? Mm-hmm. In terms of anthropology, it's what people believe. Mm. And it's what people believe is often revolves around the unseen. And if you can't have faith in the law, you can't have faith that someone will be held accountable for your son's murder, then what do you have faith in? And I think for Sito's family and for his community, a lot of what they found faith in is the spirituality. Mm-hmm. And so for me to not talk about that didn't seem, it was just partial. It wasn't the full story. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to talk about that. And I wanted to figure out ways to talk about that. And to make a point about how do we search for justice outside of the parameters of law? How do we imagine a new possibility, a new world outside of the one prescribed to us? And I think spirituality plays a big role in that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, my last question before we turn to the audience is, you've written about gangs and disability in Chicago, who gets left with all of these shootings, people who actually survive shootings, the impact of that on their lives and their communities. You've written about police torture in Chicago, the police network in that city that tortured black men into making confessions for capital crimes that put many of them on death row, but also the campaign and activism that helped to expose that. How does this work fit with those other two books? What do you see as a through line in your work looking at these questions of violence, the questions of the role of the state involved in that, police, the criminal legal system? What are some of the things that constitute your work?
I think in a practical sense, my experience looking at gang violence really helped me understand some of the things that Sito was up against and things that he was dealing with in order to navigate his reality and his neighborhood and his community as a young person, mm-hmm. particularly as a young boy of color in the Bay Area. So I think it's a different context for gangs and different gangs and different ways in which they operate, but there's a lot of similarities when we think about the era of mass incarceration and mm-hmm. people being locked up, generations of being locked up, and how young people coming up, you know, in the midst of that, how they then see the world and the kind of allegiances they look towards. And then when you know, to understand Sito's cases and his incarceration and the work of the municipal government, a lot of the stuff in the torture letters and the torture cases helped me with that mm-hmm. because I was familiar with, you know, how closely DAs work with the police and mm-hmm. and how that also impacts judges and sentencing and how much it doesn't matter what you say or mm-hmm. what you've done, how that vilification can rob you of life. So in a practical sense, I understood certain, I would say, like sociological and historical features that impacted Sito's life. But I think on a conceptual level, I'm interested in injury in my work. And I'm explicitly interested in injury rather than violence, because injury entails violence, but it's more than violence. When you think about injury, there's also a chance for healing. There's a chance for repair. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested in both the violence, but also what are the ways that people are trying to heal? What are the ways that people are trying to repair, both in an individual and a communal sense? And those were the themes that I was also grappling with in Sito. I think the difference is that I'm trying to just lay the contradictions out, lay them bare. I don't necessarily say that this is the answer.
Right.
Yeah. But I think that's useful. I think that when mm-hmm. we think about abolition and when we think about these issues that Sito cared about really deeply, I think we gloss over some of the emotional component
right.
that I'm trying to get at. I think we logically speak about it. Oh, even if somebody did
yep.
a horrific crime,
yep.
but these are all the reasons why it's not great to lock them up. It's,
right.
it costs this much, it does, you know? But we're not up against logic a lot
right.
of times. We're
right.
up against the potency, the emotional potency of DA pointing to the mother and saying, I'm going to, you know, get justice for this mother. And
right.
this mother wants the child to be tried as an adult.
Right.
And so we're up against that. We have to understand that, what
mm-hmm.
it feels like, what it means, how to grapple with that, how to wrestle with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's some of the things I try to unravel in the book.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I really enjoyed about the book is that it was not easy and simple with, you know, these questions about abolition and what you do, you know, not just about police violence or the violence of the criminal justice system, but how do you respond to violence within the community and with, you know, amongst people who live there, that it's not an easy answer. And I think I agree with you. Sometimes it is kind of responded to in a simplistic way that removes the way, because one of the things that I thought about with Sito's mother during the sentencing is what it means when you have your son has been degraded socially by the state itself, that it feels like a continuation of that if you don't get what is perceived to be justice, right? So it's not just retribution. It's about seeing this person as a person who was worthy of receiving what is believed to be the dignity of justice, and to not have that makes what is a loss feel even more of a loss, that it
yeah.
really was for nothing, that this person can just walk away from that, because that is how our society has set this up. And that is part of the kind of, it's not just emotional, but it's connected to the way that people are characterized, the way that people are seen as social beings in, you know, in this in this country, and it compounds that. So it's very complicated.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Thank you for telling us about Sito. And when you said something about at the end of his life, he was only 19.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That just really, you know, that really struck me. So I wanted to lift up the Amir Healing Center here in Germantown. Amir stands for Every Murder Is Real, and it was founded by a mom and two sisters of a murder victim who wanted to support families in healing and repairing. And I want to tell them about this book because I think it would really make them feel hopeful, because they want their loved ones to be remembered and known. And the concept of injury really stuck out, and almost feels like that could be a paradigm shift for the system as a whole. Can you say more about like where your work is headed on that topic?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think it's a major theme of my work. It's how I approach my work, I would say. But I look at it on different scales and different levels. So first, I think there's individual healing. And in my first book, when I worked with people who had been injured as a result of gun violence, that moment of being shot, oftentimes when someone's in the hospital learning how to eat, learning how to pick up a fork, learning how to protect their body by doing things like raising off their seat ever so often so they don't get sores that could threaten their life. This is a radical adjustment, and it's a way of shifting their orientation towards the world. And so part of repair in that context is knowing that you're not gonna be the same person, but you can be a different person, and you can have a different orientation towards life. So what is that orientation going to be? That's also a moment where people are more open to intervention. Mm. Studies show that, you know, you can get people at that moment and to rethink about whether they want vengeance or what that's going to look like, and how else can their life look. So with injury, I think, comes different opportunities as well on the individual level. But there's also a social level to injury. And that is, I think, our policies injure. You know, when you think about mass incarceration, you think about redlining, when you think about the state of the school system. Mm-hmm. You know, in some of the communities that I worked in, there was, you know, 76%. High school dropout rate, you know? So by the time you have that reality, you're really putting people in an injurious state socially, right? So how do we think about the interface between individual injury, social injury, and then the possibility of repair? And then you have really explicit intentional activism that seeks redress for that injury, or however it's defined, whether it's against police violence or prison industrial complex, whether it's, you know, anti-violence work or something like that. So you have organizations and social movements. And I think for me, the question is, as an anthropologist, what are people already doing to address these issues within communities? Oftentimes, again, the presumption is that an expert will come in with the solution. But in all of my experience, I found that the best solutions are already taking place. It's not that people don't have great ideas or great strategies for addressing injury. It's that they're under-resourced and not listened to. And so how can my work amplify what people are already doing in that space? And so I think about injury along those lines.
Okay, well, thank you so much. This is a fantastic book, Paige Turner. I couldn't put it down. And I just really appreciate your vulnerability and bravery in writing this book. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for engaging with the work and, you know, just great conversation. Yeah, I appreciate
it. And thanks all of you for coming. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.